The language used in the discourse surrounding sex, sexuality, and sexual orientation is, perhaps, even more diverse than the act itself.
He was gay and black at a time when that really wasn't widely accepted. Mm-hmm. And he made the unthinkable choice to be true to himself, meaning his sexual orientation, at the expense of fame and fortune, which I see as an absolutely breathtaking decision.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Same-gender marriages reign in Spain, unraveling the words of queer sexuality and the man behind the music who lived outside the closet. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 16, 2005. Spanish gays and lesbians contracted legal marriages for the first time this week. The first to marry was a couple of 30 years standing, Emilio Menéndez Menéndez and Carlos Batarin Germán. The happy couple exchanged rings before television cameras, and reporters may have outnumbered their family and friends. They hadn't actually planned to be the first. That just reflected the schedule of the Madrid suburb where they married. The town of Tres Cantos is run by the Partido Popular, which vigorously opposed marriage equality. It's not known if the town's PP mayor actually refused to perform the civil ceremony. City Councilmember José Luis Martínez of the gay-supportive United Left Coalition presided instead. He phrased the closing pronouncement, "I declare you united in matrimony," instead of the traditional husband and wife. The men also dispensed with the traditional kiss, hugging each other instead. Another political presence was activist Pedro Zerolo, who serves as Spain's top official for social issues for the ruling Socialist Party. He called the controversial new marriage legislation a triumph of common sense and the state of the law. Newlywed Menéndez said afterwards, "Today we are even more of a family."
Soon to become even more of a family is a Brazilian gay male couple who this week won a first-in-the-nation court ruling allowing them to adopt a child together. Vasco Pereira da Gama and Dorival Pereira da Carvalho, a couple of 13 years standing who live in Candanduva in the state of Sao Paulo, are hoping to adopt a 2 to 4 year old girl. Judge Julio César Spoladori Domingo's decision, which is final, found that since Brazil's Psychology Council has declared that homosexuality is not a disease, a disturbance, or a perversion, there is no valid reason to deny joint adoptions to same-gender couples. Da Gama and De Carvalho had already been vetted by a psychologist, social workers, and a public prosecutor. Brazil already allows individual gays and lesbians to adopt children.
But only one gay or lesbian parent will be able to sign a Roman Catholic baptismal certificate in Canada, even if there's a legal civil marriage. That's what a spokesperson for the National Conference of Catholic Bishops told a Senate committee this week, adding that the church will refuse baptism altogether should both parents insist on being acknowledged. This was greatly disturbing to at least one Catholic senator, but the committee went on to decide it will report back to the full Senate in the coming week with a recommendation to enact the government's bill for marriage equality without amendments. A final floor vote in favor is expected to follow quickly. The final step of royal assent from the UK's Queen Elizabeth could come on the day of that vote, although some opponents of marriage equality are writing to her hoping for a veto.
But Alberta's staunchly conservative Premier Ralph Klein has acknowledged what's apparently inevitable, announcing the province will not pursue a futile legal challenge to the soon-to-be-enacted marriage law. He said this week, "We will proceed to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, much to our chagrin, following proclamation of the Federal Civil Marriage Act. We will develop legislative options to ensure the rights of religious officials and those Albertans who hold social or cultural beliefs or values, whether religious or non-religious, so that no one will be required to advocate, promote, or teach about marriage in a way that conflicts with their beliefs."
Although the national government believes it's already adequately ensured religious freedom in the federal bill, Justice Minister Erwin Kotler encouraged other provinces and territories to enact their own such protections. The province of Manitoba, by contrast, has required all its marriage commissioners to marry same-gender couples, and that's led a dozen of them to quit. Saskatchewan has imposed the same requirement, and it was reported this week that the Provincial Human Rights Commission has summoned one dissenting marriage commissioner in Regina to answer to a discrimination complaint.
A left-wing opposition party in Greece this week declared its support for marriage equality. Synapsismo coalition leader Alekos Alavanos told a group of lesbi-gay activists his party was committed to end all forms of discrimination, including the exclusion of same-gender couples from marriage. Although the National Human Rights Committee said earlier this year that the nation should create registered domestic partnerships, the current Greek government has not acted on that advice and is known to oppose opening marriage to gay and lesbian couples.
In the U.S., New Paltz, New York's mayor, Jason West, will not be prosecuted for solemnizing the marriages of two dozen gay and lesbian couples last year. Ulster County District Attorney Don Williams announced this week that he's dropped the misdemeanor charges of violating the state domestic relations law with each marriage, adding that to proceed further would serve no practical purpose. Any additional action would serve only to advance personal agendas in a highly volatile manner. He clarified that meant he feared the trial would be exploited by those with a greater interest in publicity than the public good and be filled with rhetoric and hyperbole as it becomes a showcase for marriage equality supporters. Previously, a New Paltz court had dismissed the charges only to have an Ulster County court reinstate them, a decision the top state court declined to review. West could have faced fines and a year behind bars. His attorney called the DA's decision a total and complete vindication. West himself said there doesn't seem to be any reason why Williams would not have made the same decision a year and a half ago, except for now he didn't think he would win. West is still prohibited by a state court order from marrying any more same-gender couples until such time as New York may legally license them.
New York State Legislature did take one step towards recognizing unmarried couples at the end of June, passing a bill creating a death care proxy. By filling out a form, a New Yorker can specify an individual to be responsible for disposition of their remains. That individual can be a domestic partner regardless of gender, and the proxy will give that person standing equal to a surviving legal spouse. Almost 80% of the state assembly approved the bill, while the Senate supported it unanimously.
In other U.S. legislative news, Hawaii's Republican Governor Linda Lingle this week vetoed protections from discrimination based on gender identity and expression in employment, but allowed to pass into law without her signature a bill extending protections from discrimination based on both gender identity and sexual orientation in housing. Although support for the jobs rights bill was strong enough that the legislature might have overridden the governor's veto, the legislative session ended without such a vote being taken. Lingle complained in her veto message about the job bill's definition of gender identity and expression, saying it would create problems for business. But the same language appeared not only in this year's housing bill, but also in the hate crimes bill she signed into law 2 years ago.
Two hate crime bills were signed into law by Illinois' Democratic Governor Rod Blagojevich at the end of June, both including sexual orientation among the victim categories. One makes it a civil rights violation either to discriminate in housing transactions or to use intimidation to prevent a housing transaction. The other creates a hate crime for harassment by means of electronic communication.
The United Church of Christ's groundbreaking resolution supporting marriage equality appears to have sparked a hate crime against one of its churches in Virginia this week. Graffiti, including UCC Sinners and Gays Lovers, were spray-painted on the outside walls and a fire was set in the sanctuary of the St. John's Reformed UCC in Middlebrook. Because it's an attack on a church, federal agents are joining with local officials in the investigation, even though U.S. federal law does not recognize anti-gay attacks as hate crimes.
Also in response to UCC's marriage resolution, Kenya's National Council of Churches will be meeting to decide if it will continue to accept funds from the U.S. denomination's charitable arm, Global Ministries. That money has been supporting at least 25 congregations and 15 related institutions in Kenya.
Pride celebrations continue. In Hungary this week, more than 1,000 people marched in the 10th annual parade in Budapest. Heavy police protection ensured there was no interference, although a score of counter-demonstrators wore T-shirts reading, Child Protection.
In Venezuela last week, Caracas had its biggest pride parade ever with more than 3,000 marchers. Their leading demands were legal recognition for same-gender couples and an end to police abuse.
In Italy this week, Rome's pride parade attracted a crowd of more than 50,000, not all of them supportive. The march's lead banner read, 2,000 years of discrimination, get the church out of the state. A number of marchers and at least one float specifically called for legal recognition of same-gender couples, and some praised Spain's enactment of marriage equality. At the halfway point, the music, whistles, and shouting all stopped for a minute of silence in recognition of last week's bombings in London. Some marchers also wore black armbands for London's losses.
And finally, that London police spokesperson you may have seen on TV discussing the investigation of the bombings is an openly gay man, Deputy Assistant Police Commissioner Brian Paddock. His often controversial career spans 30 years. As number two in populous London's Metropolitan Police hierarchy, some consider him the highest-ranking openly gay male police officer in the world.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 16, 2005, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm John Beaupre.
His lush life was considered scandalous by some, but his contribution to American music will long outlive his critics. We'll tune in to the sophisticated sounds of Billy Strayhorn later in the program.
Hi, my name is Billy Bean, and I was a Major League Baseball player from 1986 to 1995. I started with the Detroit Tigers. I played for the Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Diego Padres. I am gay, and you're listening to a show that hits it out of the park every week. This Way Out Radio Magazine.
When saying it with flowers just won't do, language and sexuality might help. This Way Out's Janet Mason peruses the new book about queers, words, and sex.
In Language and Sexuality from Cambridge University Press, authors Deborah Cameron and Don Kulik, respectively a lesbian and a gay man, analyze the language of queer sexuality by navigating through a maze of 1960s/70s lesbian feminist and gay liberation analysis and through the subsequent overlapping landscape of queer theory. The language used in the discourse surrounding sex, sexuality, and sexual orientation is, perhaps, even more diverse than the act itself. The author's research and writing of this scholarly text leads to the intersections of language and theory, which is where most of us live our lives rather than tossing in our lot with one camp, so to speak, or another. One signature of same-sex linguistic cultures, call them what you will, gay speak, queer speak, etc., is the fluidity to move from one lexicon to the other. This comes from the historic necessity of passing, whether it is a gay person assumed to be straight or one gender in guise of another. Drag queens have elevated this to high art. The authors note, Judith Butler herself invoked drag queens at the end of her book, Gender Trouble, to make the general point that we all, in effect, pass at doing gender, since gender is not the expression of an inner essence. Explaining one's sexual identity has not existed through history, and consequently the silences, what is not said or cannot be said, are equally as important as what has been put into words. These silences culminated in The Love That Dare Not Speak Its Name, associated with the trial of Oscar Wilde in the late 19th century. And during one of the trials of Radcliffe Hall in Britain, the attempt to criminalize lesbian relationships in the early 20th century failed because the Lord Chancellor and other prominent citizens argued in hushed whispers, one assumes, that to speak of lesbianism, even to forbid it, was to risk popularizing and spreading it among the untainted female citizenry. The authors note, that the naming of sexuality is a relatively modern phenomenon. The term heterosexual was coined in 1869, the same year as homosexual, and originally denoted a perversion, having sex with someone of the other gender for pleasure rather than to reproduce. Major differences exist between the concepts of gay and lesbian feminist liberation and queer theory, but the ultimate difference may be, in fact, linguistic. While queer is an umbrella term that is more inclusive, the authors note that the term is very often used to denote gay or lesbian with a hipper, more radical edge. The authors note that as the debate continues, the meaning of queer and its relationship to other words will no doubt continue to shift. It remains to be seen, however, what the next word or whisper will be. This is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, reviews of LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org. You can also demonstrate your solidarity by taking part in an online benefit auction. Look for the This Way Out area at alternabid.com. Again, to find out more about special CD thank you gifts, subscriptions, and the auction, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA.
Decades before gay pride was even conceivable, one of American music's least known but most accomplished arranger composers rejected glory and gold to stay true to himself. No less than the legendary Duke Ellington called Billy Strayhorn his musical companion. Simeon Pillage discusses the jazz great's life and music with biographer David Hajdu in this melodious profile produced and introduced by Roy Hurst.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come-with-me places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of
some of the most recognizable songs in the genre called classic American music was composed by a little-known musician named Billy Strayhorn. But Billy Strayhorn's brilliance and his anonymity are tied to a career-long collaboration with the genius of Duke Ellington. Ellington is perhaps the greatest and certainly one of the most well-known composers in American history, and that may explain why Strayhorn's most famous works are associated with the Ellington legend. A Billy Strayhorn biography has surfaced to give more than one reason why Strayhorn isn't exactly a household name. The book is called Lush Life. Simeon Pillage caught up with its author, New York writer David Hajdu, and asked him to shed a bit more light on Strayhorn's accomplishments.
What exactly did Strayhorn do, and if he was so great, why isn't he better known?
He did a lot more than he ever said on the record or than was ever covered in the vast literature on Duke Ellington, and the fact that he said so little accounts for why he wasn't better known. It was largely by choice. Strayhorn was one of the great composers of American history, the composer who combined classical music with vernacular music all through a very original prism with great depth and sophistication. He produced absolutely magnificent music, but chose to do most of it, not all of it, but most of it in the shadow of another composer working for and with Duke Ellington. And he made that choice to avert scrutiny, to specifically to avoid answering questions about his sexual orientation because he was gay and black, essentially a double minority,
yeah.
at a time when that really wasn't widely accepted.
Mm-hmm.
So, broad terms, those are the answers.
Right.
Is lonely again, and only last year.
How did Billy Strayhorn first meet Duke Ellington? Can you tell us about that?
Sure. He met him in December of 1938. At that point, Duke offered Strayhorn work. He did some arrangements. He added some lyrics to Ellington's tunes, and Duke offered him an opportunity that week to come to New York and work with him.
Yeah, was he hired primarily as a lyricist first? Is that what Duke heard first, or did he hear both?
No. The first thing that Duke asked him to do was write an arrangement, which he did while he was still in Pittsburgh, and that Ellington performed while he was in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And he showed how he would expand and Ellingtonia, bringing in Western classical music and his own point of view, because Strayhorn was classically trained. He went to conservatory, and he had his own point of view. So he brought several new dimensions to Ellingtonia, and he showed that to Duke. Mm-hmm. And what he chose to do to demonstrate what he could do for Duke was take Duke's subway instructions. Duke said, well, come see me in Harlem, and he wrote down instructions on how to get to his house, and he turned that into take the A train.
Huh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. Now, Duke and Billy seemed to be on the same musical wavelength. And so were their influences and musical training similar? You mentioned that Billy had a classical background. Can you tell us?
They were on the same wavelength in many ways, but in more ways, I think, they were symbiotic, that their differences complemented each other.
Mm-hmm.
Ellington was largely self-taught and took fierce pride in his autodidacticism. You know,
mm-hmm.
he should, and he emerged as a totally individualistic artist. In part, you know, because he had been freed of sort of the strictures and the rigors of formal training. Strayhorn was conservatively trained, more traditionally trained. He had a depth of knowledge of the Western tradition, which he brought to bear in a way that made his music a bit more conservative than Ellington's. Ellington would do anything and try anything.
Mm-hmm.
You could say maybe he didn't know the rules. I think he didn't care about the rules. He
right.
didn't care. That was the nature of Ellington's genius. The nature of Strayhorn's brilliance was different. His work was through composed, it was emotional, it was different from Ellington's in that it dealt with different shades in the emotional spectrum. It was, you got a different feeling from
right.
Strayhorn's music.
Right.
You know, Ellington's music so vigorous and sort of had a lot of machismo and power and force and confidence. And Strayhorn's music expressed a whole different range of emotion.
Now, I've also heard, rumors back and forth, yes and no, that Ellington and he were somehow romantically linked at some point. Do you know anything about that, and does that really matter?
I never heard anything to that effect. Mm-hmm. And I researched my book for over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's irrelevant but clear that they loved each other.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason, it's irrelevant if they touched each other. There's no question. And Ellington was, he couldn't have embraced Strayhorn emotionally more than he did, and or been more public in his expressions of genuine affection for Strayhorn. And not more than affection, a very, very deep love. How do you describe that love? Is it familial? Is it paternal?
Mm-hmm.
Is it fraternal? What is it?
Mm-hmm.
Who? How do you name it? How do you categorize it? I'm not a psychologist. They loved each other very deeply. Strayhorn's death affected Ellington in a way that nothing short of the death of his own mother did.
Mm-hmm.
He described him in public as, sort of cryptically, as his writing and arranging companion. That was the word he used. He evoked companionship in his describing of Strayhorn. Not my collaborator, my aide-de-camp, my, you know, not my colleague,
right.
My companion.
He made no secret of his homosexuality. He and Strayhorn and his lover lived together as a couple at a period in history that was slightly less tolerant of this lifestyle than today.
Slightly?
Yeah, right. Right. And, of course, the jazz world at that time was quite macho. What was life like for Billy Strayhorn as an openly gay man, especially among what I call macho jazz musicians?
Well, his homosexuality and the fact that he was open about his homosexuality is the answer to the question of his anonymity. I mean, he knew that he couldn't be a public figure and a band leader and be outward and open about his homosexuality. It was unthinkable in those days. You'd have to have, you'd be interviewed and you'd have to answer questions, and it just really wouldn't be accepted. So he knew that, and he made the unthinkable choice to be true to himself as a man, as a person, as an individual, be true to his identity, meaning his sexual orientation, at the expense of fame and fortune, which I see as an absolutely breathtaking decision, a heroic decision,
right,
to sacrifice fame and fortune in this country that reveres it above all. What makes this country run, you know, glorification of celebrity, and here's a figure who had everything in the palm of his hands to achieve it himself, and he said he gave it up so that he could walk down the street and say, "I'm who I am," in his own words. "You don't like it, that's your problem."
That's right. Right.
Extraordinary.
What something to someone to make my life an adventurous dream.
David Haydu's book is called Lush Life, a Billy Strayhorn biography.
Roy Hurst produced that music-filled profile featuring Simeon Pillage's conversation with Billy Strayhorn biographer David Haydu. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Graham Underhill, Rex Wachner, Martin Rice, Janet Mason, and Roy Hurst contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Don't forget you can listen to This Way Out online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please find out how you can help keep this program on the air by visiting our website. You can also email tworadio@aol.com to sign up for our monthly This Way Out updates and or to get our weekly program information messages. And to be sure you don't miss a week of This Way Out, you can subscribe to audio CDs of our program. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on 2UUU Nowra, New South Wales, KFAI, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, WZKW, Kingsville, Ohio, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned.